You're just coming off a wedding, getting married, and I happened to see part of the video of your wedding, and you had an Elvis impersonator there, right?
We did. He officially married us. Elvis did, so it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think you were the first person on this podcast that's gotten married via Elvis. So, congratulations on that.
Thank you. I'm pretty lucky. I feel pretty lucky.
How did he do? I mean, when you decide to go the route of having an Elvis impersonator officiate a wedding, what are you looking for? You're looking for like, this guy's got to be able to sing. This guy's got to have the personality. This guy's got to like actually be official.
A little bit of everything, because I think for a second wedding we wanted to just really, we were going to do the big formal thing, and then at the last minute literally said we're going to take off to Vegas. So we grabbed our kids and we had done some research, and we wanted our thing is, I have friends all over the world, and obviously couldn't invite them. So one of the things that really intrigued us is that they did online streaming, so that we could invite everybody in the world that we knew, and they could watch it happen. So it's kind of fun, because we actually had so many people watching it, they crashed their server.
Oh my gosh.
A lot of people didn't get to see it because their hits were so big. So it was kind of funny, but it was neat to share what we could share of it.
That's really awesome. We are talking to Sandy Pooch. She is the co-founder of Now Lay Me Down to Sleep. She's also a well-known photographer. She's an explorer of light for Canon, which establishes her as one of the best 60 photographers in the world. She's a public speaker. She teaches everywhere. She's got her own university, Sandy Pooch University. I guess that's for photographers or something. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit. But you are a world traveler. You told me before you got on that you were on the road for like 8 months out of the year. That's like mind-blowing to me how much travel that is.
You know, I have been doing it for the last 15 years, and with the big tours about the last 10 years. So for me, it's kind of become a lifestyle. I have kids, and they live on the tour bus, you know, for many months out of the year. And then when we're outside of the country, you know, it's all airplanes. And it's definitely a lifestyle, but I have the opportunity to not only see the world, but meet people and share my passion for photography, as well as share the work that we do with Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. So I have a great reach that I can sort of spread the word and hopefully get more people involved.
You know, since I cover sports and I've covered, you know, major tennis events and major golf events, and it's always, you know, those sports especially because it's individual and there's really no off season. And there's not much of an off season for either of those sports. And these guys and girls are on the road for 8, 9, 10 months out of the year, traveling all over the world, especially the tennis players traveling all over the world. It's like, it seems like it'd be so exhausting. And there's, I know you have a place you call home in Colorado, but it almost seems like you're a wanderer, or these people are kind of wanderers. They just go around the world every year. It seems like it'd be really hard to get used to.
You know, it's funny. It's something, it becomes a lifestyle. And so for me, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. to catch a 6 a.m. flight, to get to the hotel by 4, to get to a class by 6, you know, it becomes a lifestyle. But I think what you enjoy are, there are certain moments, you know, in every city, literally every city in America. I've been to every major city, and I have a favorite restaurant or a favorite place to go hang out. And, you know, around the world, I have friends in different cities, so I know where to eat and where to, you know, what's the best entertainment. So it's kind of fun because you work really hard, but you also, there are just these moments, people, relationships, and then places that, you know, sometimes I feel very privileged that I have seen, you know, the sunrise in almost every city in America, and I've seen the best of each city. I've been doing this enough years, you know, 15 years on the road, I've seen the best of everything. And, you know, some of it I'm over, like you can only go to New York City so many times, but it never gets old.
Right.
But, you know, Idaho, maybe not quite as entertaining, although I love Idaho too. Don't want to offend anyone out there, but I mean, it's a beautiful place, but you kind of run out of entertainment. So then you get a little more solitude. So it's definitely, different, but, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I love it.
And logistically, if you're traveling this country and you get your kids with you, I mean, how do they enjoy the traveling, or how does that, I mean, traveling for work, I know, can, if you have kids, it's at times almost like a respite. Like, okay, I get, I get a little bit peace and quiet. I get a hotel room. I can like lay low for a little bit. But with your kids, how does that dynamic change things?
You know what? We live on a tour bus, so very much like a band would. So they have bunk beds on the bus, and then I have sort of a room in the back. It's called a Star Coach, and it has a bedroom in the back. So I have my own private space, and they've got all their bunk beds. And so when we're on the road, private space is all of about 4 feet behind them. But but you know, it's fun because they really got used to, you know, every morning we drive through the night on the road tours, and so we'd wake up in the morning and they'd be in a brand new city. So for them, it would be, let me check out the pool, let me check out the room, let me, you know, they'd run around the hotel. And then we always, the biggest thing is we always plan break days in the really fun cities. So if I'm doing the East Coast, we would have a couple extra days in New York or a couple extra days in D.C. So we plan some cool activities. So for them, it's pretty much, the norm. They've been all over the world. And so I think that for kids, I think when you expose them to different cultures and different people, I think you really affect their lives. They realize how big the world is and yet how similar we all are. The needs that we have and the hopes and the desires and the fears. I mean, it's just very lateral across the world. So I think it's really been really healthy for them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you can expand their horizons that way and bring them new cultures, that's a really great thing. What are you actually teaching? I mean, what are you doing on the road so much? What's like your job?
I have a studio here in Colorado, so I do own a studio and I shoot here about 4 to 6 months out of the year, depending on my travel schedule. And then the rest of the time, I'm on the road around the United States. I do anywhere from 30 to 50 cities. So I just got off 2 weeks ago this spring's tour, and it was this one was on posing and lighting. And each year, I teach a completely different concept. So I've taught baby photography 1 year, then it was children's, then it was family, then the next year it was wedding, and then it was pinup photography and boudoir. And this year it was really more of a 101. And the reason I did that is obviously going through some changes. I was getting married, second marriage, and I wanted, having founded Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep 9 years ago, I really felt like the momentum had grown so much in the beginning, and then it kind of tapered off. And I really felt like I needed to contribute back to this organization. I always mention it and I always promote it, but I wanted to do something sort of far greater. I had been feeling very blessed with my life. And so this last tour, the 32 cities, we dedicated, we actually turned all of the funding over to Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. So the entire tour, anybody that bought a ticket, the money went directly to them. So it was a certainly not a profit generator for me, but to cover my expenses, I'm sponsored by, you know, some of the, obviously, companies like Canon and Adobe and all of the big companies in the industry. So they certainly were supportive. But really what I did is I decided every city that I went to, one day I would teach, and then the second day I would photograph photographers. So I opened up my skills to photographers and said, hey, let's get your fit. Because photographers, just like any other business, you know, you can take people's pictures, but you never take your own. So I wanted to give photographers across the country an opportunity to have their portraits taken because they just don't do it enough. And so it was a very small fee compared to my normal prices, but I made it affordable. And that sort of helped subsidize my travel expenses, and which gave me the ability to, for the show portion, the Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep portion, they were able to capture all that money. So the money was helpful. I think they appreciated it. But I think more than that, the audience that I teach is a group of photographers. So I was able to share the message of what Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep is, and let photographers especially know that they could provide that service and contribute. So it was kind of a win-win for everybody. It's definitely not something I could do twice. I mean, economically, you know, it was a risk, and and towards the end I was getting a little nervous, but you know what, things like that always work out. And it was wonderful. It was just a great, very different for me, because typically my tours are kind of for profit and obviously part of my income. Taking that off the plate was different, because it really helped me kind of focus on the task at hand, which was gaining members and educating people on what the organization does.
So normally you're teaching photographers. I mean, are they like amateur photographers or professionals, or who's your client base, I guess?
Typically a show, a big show for me, there'd be anywhere from 400 to 600 people in the room. All Oh, wow. Photographers, the majority of them are pro level. And then of course, amateurs, up and comings are definitely there. The industry has changed a lot in the last 5 years. So, you know, in 2008, 2009, we would see about 15,000 photographers a year. Now with internet and so much, I mean, obviously I have an online resource for training as well, but now it's so easy, information so readily available online that a typical show could be 100 to 200 people. Again, mainly I'm finding less pros and more up and comings because they're just clamoring for information. So it's kind of a fun group because they're very, very starry-eyed and excited about what we're doing.
And before we get into to now laying me down to sleep, let me just, I always forget to do this. It's unbelievable. I always forget to do it, but it's, you're at Sandy Puch, which is S-A-N-D-Y-P-U-C on Twitter. And you're,
correct.
You're, is it sandypuchtours.com? Is that your website?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep. S-A-N-D-Y-P-U-C-tours.com. And so, you can also just go to sandypuch.com, and that will access you to, we have multiple educational sites and touring sites, and I do a lot of personal traveling, so there's a lot of fun there as well.
You know, it's so I talked to Cheryl last week. You're the co-founder of Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, and I told her this, but it was, you know, when I ran across your website, and I can't remember how I even found you guys, but I did, and I wrote an email, and then I didn't send it. And then I waited like 6 months before I even sent it. And I don't know why that was. And before I actually called Cheryl, I had to like sit for like 10 or like 5 minutes and like try and figure out, okay, how am I going to get into this? How am I going to... Normally when I start a podcast, it's like we're in the middle of a conversation and it's really easy to come up with something, whether it's like I did like with you. It's like talking about your wedding for a minute or talking about whatever. But I have had a really hard time trying to figure out how am I even gonna get into this, because it seems like such a sensitive topic. What is a sensitive topic, and it's sometimes can be hard to talk about. But when you talk about Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep and what you guys are doing, which is basically photographing babies who are either gonna die or have died, I guess there's two schools of thought. One, it's like, and talking to Cheryl, it's like, God, what you guys do was amazing, and especially because you probably provide the service for free, and another school of thought could be, well, you say, well, listen, that's kind of morbid. I don't even want to be involved with that. So it's kind of a weird, I don't know, for me, it was kind of a weird contradiction.
Yeah, it's something that obviously when we founded this, Anna, and with Cheryl, I'm sure she told you the foundation. I mean, when Cheryl went to the hospital to have her baby, she had no idea she was going to lose her son. This was her fourth child, and she was just going to have another baby, and she'd done it 3 times successfully before. So when Maddox was born and they realized that he had a condition that was incompatible with life, one of the things that was really important to them is they wanted to have a photograph. And my work hangs in most of the hospitals here in Colorado. So I specialize in babies and children. And so a lot of the hospitals have asked for display work. And so they happened to see my work there. And so they literally just figured out, they researched my name and contacted my studio. Now, when I went down and met them that night, I didn't realize how grave the situation was. I knew their son was critically ill, but I did not realize he was not going to survive. And so that night that I met them, it was explained to me via her husband that he was unable to breathe on his own, and that their request was unusual in the sense that he said, you know, he told me, he said, as you can see, you know, Maddox is covered with tubes and wires and he can't really be held very comfortably. And what my wife wants more than anything is this. And he pointed to an image that I had photographed that was hanging on the wall. And it was a beautiful, we call it a Madonna portrait, a mother and a baby, very, you know, bare skin. Mom had bare skin, baby laying against her chest, really mm-hmm. beautiful, sweet portrait. And he made that request, and he said, and then he turned to me and he said, so I'm wondering if you would consider waiting until he passes away, and then would you photograph him with his mother this way? Now, of course, I never had a request like that. I photographed, mm-hmm. you know, many dire situations, but never had I been asked to photograph a deceased child. And so I know I immediately said yes, but I remember my head going, holy cow, there's no way I can do this. But my heart, of course, said yes, and I nodded yes, and that was the agreement. So it was through that session. The first part of the session, Maddox was alive. What people don't realize when they see the images is when you see images with hit tubes and wires on him, there was actually a nurse laying on the floor, actually breathing for him. She had the little breathing apparatus and was squeezing it so that he could live. Mm-hmm. And so those images were very difficult to take, because not only did we have mom, dad, and baby covered in wires, but we also had a nurse, you know, trying to make that work was hard. And so after I had photographed that series, I remember getting really nervous, because as I was shooting, it hit me really hard as in the first series, that all of a sudden it was about halfway through and I realized, oh my gosh, when I stop shooting, they're going to take this little boy off life support and he's going to die. And I remember just my heart racing, thinking, oh my gosh, don't forget anything. You know, I was so afraid that I was going to miss something. And so, but there was a point where I realized I absolutely had everything I could possibly capture: his toes, his eyelashes, his ears, his hair. I mean, I documented every square inch of that little boy that I could. And so it was at that point that I stepped out of the room. And then it was about 45 minutes later that the nurse came back and told me that that he had passed and that I could come back in. And I remember when she came out, the first thing I saw, her face, her eyes were swollen, and you could tell she'd been crying pretty hard. And I just remember, sorry, I get a little emotional here, but I'll never forget that, because I always thought nurses had this incredible job where they got to, you know, give, you know, birth to babies. And it all of a sudden I realized how incredibly traumatic their job could be. And so she walked me back into the room. And once we walked back in, it was interesting, because previous, in the first part of the images, Cheryl was obviously very, very upset. And there were times where we had to stop because she was too emotional and take a break. And the second time, after Maddox passed, I remember walking in and the whole room was so peaceful. It was just so calm, and she was sitting there holding him, and I just remember her being so still, and it wasn't that there was no emotion. I knew without a doubt that she was holding it all in, because I knew she wanted these portraits so bad that she was going to, you know, she was going to make it through. And so we started the second part of the series, and of course, you know, if I didn't know he was gone, he looked exactly like a little sleeping baby. Yeah. It was beautiful. He was perfect from head to toe with all the tubes and wires gone. You got to see his lips and you got to see his nose. And so we did the second part of the series. And it was really that experience. So surreal is the only word that I can use, because it's something you could never explain to somebody, what it's like to, you know, watch a parent say goodbye to their child. It's pretty traumatic, and yet there's a very peaceful momentum when you know that you're capturing that moment, not to exploit it, but to give them tangible evidence that they had a child, that baby was real, and that even though it was only moments, that they'll never forget that child. And so it was through that experience. A few days later, Cheryl came down to see the images. I knew that I was going to, you know, I knew that I had to make it special. So we created a beautiful slideshow all put to music. And I wanted it to be really amazing for her. But, you know, watching her see those images and watching the emotion and going through the process of helping her understand, you know, how real he still was through those images, we started having conversations. And I remember Cheryl had a certain amount of guilt, because she felt almost guilty that she had these beautiful pictures, knowing that so many other families had lost babies that didn't have that. And it was through those conversations we kind of went back and forth. And one day we were talking, and out of the blue she said, you know what, we should start an organization where, you know, you guys take pictures of babies who are not going to make it. And I kind of was, you know, I of course wholeheartedly agreed, but to be really honest with you, and I always give Cheryl all the credit, because if I would have thought of that idea, it definitely would have gone on to the really good idea shelf, you know, the one that we all have, where it's like, yeah, that's an awesome idea, I'm going to do it someday. But she kind of took that all the grief that she had and all the emotion, and not kidding, as soon as I agreed to it, the very next day she was calling me with ideas and brochures and let's do this. And, you know, I kind of grabbed her coattails. The thing I knew I brought to the table at that time, I was literally teaching, you know, I was traveling the world, seeing anywhere from, you know, up to 15,000 photographers. So I knew really quickly that this intersection was definitely meant to be, because she had the passion and the energy, and I had the ability to literally on a weekly basis stand before hundreds and literally thousands of photographers and share with them the idea and concept. So with that combination, instead of being what I thought we were going to be, which is like a little grassroots effort here in Colorado, very, very quickly we became a very well-known worldwide organization. So that was kind of a long answer to your question, but the point was, in the beginning, 9 years ago, the word morbid came up more often than anything. People would say, oh my gosh, that's disgusting, or morbid, or oh, how could you do that? Or, you know, we would hear horrible reactions. Even the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, I don't think they were as much concerned about the morbid side of it as they were afraid that we were taking advantage of bereaved parents. Mm-hmm. But once the medical community started to realize that we were literally giving this gift and that there was no money exchanging hands, that our volunteers go there, not only do they go through this incredibly difficult process with these parents, they capture it and then they do artwork on it and then they give it back to the parents for free. And these are not, you know, morbid, graphic pictures of deceased children or dying babies. These are beautiful portraits of parents holding their children and loving them and taking care of them. So once the medical community understood that, there was a very quick turnaround. Pretty soon, instead of them being defensive and them trying to shut us down and say, you know, trying to dig into what we were really doing, all of a sudden they were saying, oh my gosh, you guys are heroes, you're angels, yeah. We love you, and they started spreading the word. And over the years, I don't hear the word morbid almost ever anymore, and it used to be such a frustration for me because it was hard to look somebody in the eye and say, I proudly take portraits of, you know, dying children. And now people get it. People understand that the gift is priceless. It literally is priceless.
You know, going back to the job that nurses have to do, this is kind of an aside, but I have twins, and they were in the NICU. They came really early. And they're in the NICU for like 6 weeks, and their path was really good. So there was never really too many concerns about them not making it. But across the little hallway was a baby who was born at like 24 weeks or something like that, just because it was not compatible. You know, being inside of her mother was just not going to work. So they had to deliver the baby. And I was visiting my kids one day, and the baby was, which had been in an incubator the entire time and had been on oxygen and all that kind of stuff, was actually outside, like on room air with nothing, you know, she's breathing on her own. You know, and they were doing the kangaroo or whatever, you know, breast to breast with a mom. And it was amazing.
Right.
It was like this little 1 pound baby is, look at what she's doing. And then the next day I was there, my kids had gained like 20 grams, and I was like, yay, that's awesome. And there was a priest across the hall because that baby had taken a bad turn. So, you know, in the NICU, those things, it's like a roller coaster. But I asked the nurse, one of the nurses who were, you're right, they're angels. And we still keep in touch with one of the nurses who was with him the whole time in the NICU. But I said, yeah, the job must be so hard because of things like that. There's like this victory, and then it's like the next day the baby's dying. And she said, yeah, that's pretty hard, but, you know, when they go home, and they go home to their family, that's the best gift we get. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
And the saddest part is the families who don't get to take a baby
right.
home. That's what you have to realize, is when you lose a child in the hospital, there's this incredible hole in your heart and in your life. And, you know, most of these parents don't know they're going to lose their child. So they go to the hospital with their diaper bags and their nurseries all painted, and they're so mm-hmm. excited, and they told all their friends and family. And literally they walk out of the hospital with a little plastic bag that's full of literature on how to grieve. And
oh,
I mean, can you imagine, like, that's it? That's all you get. I mean, they walk away with that baby and then it's over. And so, you know, as photographers, we know that what we're doing is, they might walk out of that hospital with just that bag of paperwork, but you know what? They know that their baby's portraits, that those images, those beautiful pictures that are going to literally capture that child for eternity, are going to exist. And they, it gives them hope. It gives them something to, you know, to cling to and to look forward to through those darkest hours. So it's, you know, it's one of those things where in the beginning people thought it was so strange. And to me, seeing hundreds of parents go through this, literally, I've watched more babies die than it's hard to even imagine. Mm-hmm. Like, when I sit down and think about the actual numbers, it actually makes me sad, because I think, you know, I could have never, you know, 10 years ago imagined that I would watch so many babies pass away. But knowing that those parents have those, that, you know, 10 years later, some of my first parents still cherish those images and still cling to them, it at least gives me hope that, you know, that this work is, you know, that there's value here.
Yeah, because it's proof that they existed. That's this little person existed, even for the briefest of minutes. The baby across the hall, across the little aisleway, one day was gone. They had to bring it to a different hospital for surgery, and I never heard what happened. And that baby still haunts me, because I'd never know what's going to happen to it. What happened to it?
When
you become a parent, it's crazy how stuff like that continues to affect you. I think about that baby every single day.
And for those parents, imagine, you know, you have beautiful twins, and I'm sure you can't even fathom a loss of one or both or any of that. And so when you realize, like when you spend time in the NICU, I had a son that spent a year in the NICU and in the hospital, children's hospital. And when you're in that situation, all of a sudden, like you said, you realize how precious those first few weeks and months are and how precarious they are. It's very scary.
When, you know, I talked to Cheryl about that night that Maddox died, and she talked about how emotional you were as well. And obviously, I mean, 10 years later, and that, you know, you're obviously still emotional about some of what you do. But, you know, for me, being a journalist and being in newspapers, you're taught to be, you know, objective. So, you know, there have been plenty of things I've covered on my various beats where it would be very easy to get emotional about the depths that this team went through to win the big game, or, you know, whatever it is. You know, that's ingrained in me that objectivity is above all, and there's no time for tears, and that would be inappropriate, and that would be, you'd be mocked or laughed at for that. Obviously, we're in different professions, so that's not the same thing for you, but do you still find yourself getting emotional? I mean, is that okay?
I mean, I am definitely my father's child, and he, you know, I get my emotion from him. I definitely wear my heart on the sleeve, and it doesn't take much. I tear up probably every day over something beautiful or sad or something. So, but the one thing I learned a long time ago, and actually it's interesting, Cheryl was really the person that pointed this out to me. Both of us were teaching a class about 2 years after she lost Maddox, one of the students raised their hand and they said, "I'm afraid to go into the room. I don't know what to say to people." And so I explained, I said, "Well, to be honest with you, the first night I met Cheryl, I walked in the room and I was so nervous, and she was visibly upset. And so I walked up to her and I said, you know, hi, how are you?" And of course, the way I said it, I literally heard it and I was horrified.
Yeah.
That I had said, you know, who says that to somebody who's losing a child? But I was nervous, and so I said that, and Cheryl turned to me in that class, and she said, "I don't remember you saying that." And I said, "You don't?" I said, I'm still embarrassed about it after all these times. She said, "No." She said, "The only thing I remember is that you were crying." Yeah. And it was one of those things where I realized that for her, it was the humanity, the fact that I could relate, and that I had that empathetic and sympathetic bone inside of me that helped her understand that I wasn't just a stranger coming in and morbidly capturing her child dying or deceased. I was a mother, I was a parent, I was a professional. But yeah, I definitely cried that night. And in fact, I photographed, as I said, more babies than I will ever say the number out loud. But the reality is, I have never had a session yet that I did not at some level become emotional, whether it's teary eyes or full on tears flowing. Obviously, the kind of the running joke at headquarters is, as long as the family's not consoling you, then it's okay to cry. I mean, you definitely don't want them taking care of you, then you've got a real problem. But the reality is, I would be very concerned about anybody that could do this work and not emotionally connect to it. Now, I wouldn't say that all photographers are as emotional as I am. A lot of them are a little stronger than I am, but you still feel it. And what we found, and if you ask any photographer in this organization, they will tell you the same thing. The sessions themselves, for whatever reason, just like you said, you sort of put on this professional hat and you get in there, and even if it hurts, you just do it, and you power through it because you know how important this work is. And it's a once in a lifetime. You cannot, if anything goes wrong, you cannot repeat it. So that critical nature stands true. But the hardest part for us is actually after the fact, because we have to take those images. We go home, we download them, and believe me, when you're in the room, it's very surreal and beautiful, as beautiful as a sad situation can be. When you upload them onto a computer and you open them, they become very graphic and very real and very sad. And somehow we have to use our skills to take the graphic side out of it and make it a beautiful portrait. So that's a big part of why we present the work to the families in black and white or sepia. We remove the color so that you don't see the, you know, the skin discolorations or the black lips or the black fingernails or the tearing or blood or whatever, you know, whatever would be normally startling to somebody. We make and we retouch them and we make them perfect. And so these families, even though they'll never have an experience outside of the hospital with that baby, they have a memory of an actual an event that they shared with that child, something outside of the sadness. They had a family portrait. And that's how they remember it. That's how when people talk about it, they talk about like their portrait session, as if it were like at my studio, like they were just coming to, you know, to have a session. And then, and so for them, it's the only tangible, not only the only tangible gift, the only thing, physical thing they have. It's the only, for most of them, it's the only tangible memory of doing anything with their baby outside of losing them.
Yeah. That's, you know, I didn't think of it that way in being in the room and being swept up in the emotion of the room, but it's, I guess when it's you in your, you know, workspace downloading this stuff, it's obviously it lives with the parents forever, but you have to live with that baby dying for a number of hours while you're
right.
I didn't think of it that way. Like once the session's done, it's not really done.
Yeah. And that's where it gets harder, because when you sit and you scroll through those images and you watch, you know, mom shaking and you watch dad, like I have a really hard time. I'm pretty good when mom's emotional. I can kind of keep it together. Women tend to be really strong together, but when I see a dad breakdown, I cannot keep it together. It just crushes me to see a man so upset, because, you know, we consider men to be strong and, you know, and it's hard to see them so broken. And so for me, when I see that graphically after in color, as vivid as it is in a raw capture, it's hard to look at. And so I quickly want to get through the art and editing process, because I know when I'm done, they're going to be amazing. They're going to be beautiful. They're going to be soft and personal and not so graphic. And so for us, it's really getting through that part. But what people don't realize are volunteers. These people are 100% volunteers. They not only donate their time, they actually pay a membership fee. The only way we can really fund this organization is through our membership fees, because you know, you don't receive a lot of money for this type of work. So you'll have a member, you know, that pays $25 a year to do this work. They have to go through the experience. But not only do they pack up their cars, drive to a hospital, walk into a room with a complete stranger, spend up to an hour photographing this family, watching the hardest moments of their life, they then drive home, they put away their gear, they sit down at a computer, and they may spend hours editing and doing artwork. So people don't realize it's not just the pictures. It's a, you know, 10-hour process per family. And we have volunteers who are doing 2 and 3 of these a week. And if you start doing the math, you know, that's, you know, 10. There's no way around it. It's average is about 10 hours. You can't shorten that with the type of work we do. So when you see these people who are doing 3 and 4 babies, we've got 40 hours a week in just service work.
No, I know it's millions and millions of dollars worth of photographic services that you guys are providing. So that's pretty amazing. When you go into a room now, I mean, you talked about how embarrassed you were by saying, "Hey, how you doing?" when you met Cheryl. But what's the approach now? How do you go into a room that's, you know, it's going to be sad? You know, it's going to be strangers. Obviously, they want you there because they called you or they called, you know, the service. But what's the approach now?
I think that each room is different, and that's really important that we really train our members. You will never see the same thing twice. People handle grief very differently. I have seen everything from hysterics. I've seen screaming and lamenting and yelling. I've seen anger towards God, anger towards the nurses, anger towards doctors. I've seen sheer desperation. I've walked into complete calm. I've even walked into people who are oblivious, like, I mean, I remember specifically a dad who was so checked out. I think he was so mentally trying not to be present that he was watching sports the whole time I was working. And he actually got upset with me for getting in the way of the TV set, you know, and it just, I remember being so startled. And I've been to sessions where people are laughing and not laughing, joking, but like they handle grief. And that's kind of how I am. I laugh when I'm nervous or uncomfortable or in pain. And so they're cracking jokes and being silly. And you have to realize that every family handles pain differently. Some know they're going to lose a child, so they're more prepared mentally, and maybe they've accepted it. Others, it could be a medical mistake. It could be a lot of things. So the first thing we do when we walk in a room is we kind of assess the room and look at the people and really get an idea of how they're responding just from coming in. So now we have a much more routine. I'll walk in, I say my name. I always say that I represent Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. Although all of us have our own companies, we represent the organization when we go to these rooms. I let them know that I just immediately go into explaining the session and that we'll be providing a portrait session, and that once we're done, we will do artwork on these images and we'll provide them the files. I make it very clear that no money will exchange hands, that this is a completely free gift, that they will have all the rights to the images. In some cases, the families don't speak English, so if we can get a translator, we do. We do have a formal piece of paper they have to sign. It's a legal document, and that's the one formality that is awkward, because, you know, it's always uncomfortable to have, you know, when somebody's losing a child, to say, oh, and sign these papers. But it's really important for our legal status to make sure that we're covered, that they sign those papers. And so just they give us a quick signature, and then I just explain how and what I'm going to do. Now, my first question to the family is always, would you like to hold your baby? And I ask this because you'd be surprised. A lot of parents will nod their heads no. They actually will decline holding their babies. And at first, when this first started happening to me, I was a little startled and taken aback, because I thought, how could you not want to hold your baby? It's your baby, you know. And I've learned since then that many of these families are in shock. They literally are not even addressing the fact that this is happening. They're very much in shock. They didn't know this was going to happen, and they're not dealing with it. And so it's really neat, because what happens is I ask them if they want to hold the baby, and if they say no, I say, okay, no problem. And then I explain what I'm going to do. I say, I'm going to go ahead and start working with her, and I'm going to capture images of her face, her little hands, her feet, her eyelashes. I'm going to capture every part of her. And then what I do is, if parents have declined holding the baby, I will start photographing the baby. And the one thing, as photographers, it's very natural with a baby anyway, but we treat the baby, whether it's alive or deceased, we treat the baby as if it were alive. And we talk to them. We always use the baby's name. So as I'm photographing, I'm saying, oh, you know, I'll say things like, oh, you're such a little angel. You look so beautiful. Oh, you know, Sarah, look at your little hands. They're so beautiful. And I talk to her as if she were alive. And I, if I have to move her or make changes, I always address the parents and let them know. And that process takes me like 15 to 20 minutes. And what's really, really interesting, and I'm really proud to say that by the time I get through that part, I usually will go back to mom, and let's say she's declined, and I'll say, you know, I know that you said you didn't want to hold her, but I just want to let you know that it would be really beautiful if you'd like to hold her even just for a few shots. This would be a great opportunity to do that. And what's really interesting is I have never been turned down at that point. I think what it is as the parents watch me photograph the baby alone, I think they relax and they start to become very aware of what's going on and this experience. And I think it really hits them that this is the only opportunity to do this. And so it's really interesting. I'm so glad that I learned really quickly not to take no as the answer. We never push or force people to do it, of course. But, you know, all of us who have been through that, we know that this is it. If you say no now, there's not going to be a later. And so it's really amazing to see the parents who say no all of a sudden want to hold their babies and want to be a part of those images. And we get so many thank yous later from parents who say, I am so glad you asked a second time, because they usually say something like, I didn't mean no, or I didn't mean to say no, but they're afraid. To them, I mean, think about it, to them it's kind of morbid. The idea, and lots of parents will tell me that, the idea of photographing your child dying or deceased is morbid, even for the parent, but it's also all they'll ever have. So it's a really interesting process.
Geez, Sandy, you're making me tear up with that. It really is. That's really fascinating, the psychology that goes into it. Because when you talked about, you start shooting the baby, that it makes perfect sense that they would relax and they would see, okay, this is what this process is, and giving them the second opportunity to say yes is that's amazing. How did you learn to do that? Is that just basic psychology, or how did you learn?
I think I specialize in children and babies, and so I consider photography is 80% psychology and 20% photography. So right. I think that you just learn to assess people and their emotions. And you have to realize that even any photographer that goes into it, there's a certain level of emotion and fear that goes into that. So you're overly sensitive anyway. And I just learned really quickly. I think for me, having interviewed and spoke to so many people who didn't get the services early on, I knew how important it was. And I know that in a moment of grief, sometimes we don't make the best decision. So I always wanted to give that second chance. And now that I've done it so often, I certainly don't call it a game, but it's something in my head. When they say no, it's like almost like a little personal challenge. I take it as, okay, you're saying no now, but wait. And then it's the care, I think, because when you think photography, you think very static and, you know, snap, snap, snap. But when you see somebody loving your child and touching them, you know, gently and posing their little fingers, and, you know, I think all of a sudden it becomes a lot more comforting than startling. And so it's really an amazing process to see. And it's something that, you know, people who are not photographers who have never done this, I get why you would think that would be hard to do. But once you've done one, I mean, a lot of photographers who join and have done a session, they'll say things to me like, I feel really bad because I'm not excited about my next session, but I'm kind of excited. And I know what they're really saying is, I know I have this gift, I have this ability to do this. And what we all have to remember is, no matter what, whether we photographers go to that hospital or not, those families will go home without their child. So it's not that we're excited about it, but we're excited that we can give them this gift that nobody else can. Mm-hmm. I mean, doctors and nurses are amazing, but the level of extended peace that we can give a family is pretty incredible.
How much pressure are you under, though? I mean, if you know you only get one shot at this, and obviously you've been doing it for about a decade, but I mean, you really can't screw it up. If you screw it up, it's screwed up forever.
There's nothing. Yeah. So it is. That's why we're so regimented on how we approve photographers. It's not easy. We just don't take anybody that says they could be a photographer. They do have to go through an approval process, and there's a lot of training that goes into it. I wouldn't want to scare people away. It's absolutely, I don't want to say it's easy to get in, but it's doable, and we welcome everybody. And our theory is, if let's say you're not qualified right out of the gate, let us help you learn, because we need photographers so badly. The saddest thing is, you know, we have thousands and thousands of members around the world, and yet we don't have enough providers. We turn families away every day that desperately, desperately want the work that we create, and we just don't have enough photographers. And so that's part of why I did this tour this year, is it's just so hard to imagine any family going without this. And so, you know, my goal has always been to spread the word. And obviously people like yourself, I mean, you literally have no idea how many, just this podcast alone, how many people that you will reach, and how many people that potentially may know someone or may need our services or may be able to support or provide assistance in some way. And that's, you know, that's such a gift. It's such an incredible thing that you're doing.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, which I think the first time I ran across the website, I think maybe the first photo I saw was actually Cheryl and Maddox. I think it's what, because you could see, it was like that.
Yeah,
Madonna,
that is the main image.
Yeah, it was the Madonna pose you're talking about, and you could see what I noticed was the little dimples in the knuckles, like on the hand.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But what I didn't realize for a while was that, because I was going through the website and doing some research and stuff, and I didn't realize for a few minutes that it's all free. And I was like, oh my God, these people are saints for doing this. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's what I think people don't realize. And that's why the hospitals were so protective in the beginning. They thought maybe we were trying to sell things to bereaved parents, which is a horrible concept. So we knew it had to be free, because there's just no other way to do it. And that's why, you know, I do think that the members are literally heroes. It's interesting, too, because it's now spread so far that I find myself in the most odd situations, and people realize, they either recognize my name, or they put it together. And it just, I mean, there have been times where I recently was at a convention and I was trying to order carpet for the bottom of my convention, and the woman that was doing it, she was a little frustrated and frazzled, and I had failed to do something in my paperwork. And it was funny because she looked at it, and she also, she looked at my name, and she said, "Hey, wait a minute, are you the lady that takes pictures of dead babies?" And she said it so bluntly, it kind of caught me off guard. And I said, "You mean Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep?" And she said, yeah, that's it. Are you that lady?" And I said, "Yeah, I was one of the co-founders." And she literally burst out crying. We're right in the middle of the convention center, and she burst out crying. She had just lost her granddaughter like 2 weeks before, and we had served them. And of course, all of a sudden, she was giving me carpet and doing whatever I needed. And it just, it was interesting how, you know, you start to realize that, you know, when you're in the strangest places, you know, it comes up. My mom was getting her nails done the other day, and she lives in a whole other state. And there was some ladies talking about one of their friend's baby died, and that this organization came in and they had photographed him. They were so beautiful. And my mom, of course, is like exploding, going, wait, that's my daughter, you know. So it was just kind of funny how you don't realize in life how you make one tiny move. Like the night I met Cheryl, you could have never told me that was an intersection that would literally change both of our lives for the rest of our lives. But not only that, literally at this point, tens of thousands of families can be traced back to that very moment. And that's what's kind of really awe-inspiring to me, because, you know, in the beginning, it was a lot about Cheryl and I. People wanted to interview us and get our story. And, you know, what's really cool is now I feel like we're just kind of a tiny drop in the big bucket, because we might have been the foundation, but now it's about the babies and the families we serve, and it's about the other photographers and these photographers who get up and they sacrifice so much to give this gift. And, you know, and now I don't have to do, when we started this organization, I did all of the sessions. And so, I mean, literally, you know, by the time I got to 50, I was almost hurting my own company. And then all of a sudden the whole world opened up, and now there are just tens of thousands of us. And it's really neat to see that it's kind of gone full circle now, that it, in history, number one, I know it will never end. This work will go on long after I'm gone. Mm-hmm. And long after my name and Cheryl's name, and we're not the primaries, these families will be served for hopefully forever.
For hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, 260,000 likes on Facebook, that's pretty mind-blowing. Sandy Putch, co-founder of Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, photographer extraordinaire, at Sandy Putch, SandyPuc. I encourage people to go to the website nowilaymedownasleep.org and donate. That would be helpful, I'm sure. And Sandy, thanks so much. You know, with you and Cheryl, it was really great getting to talk to you guys and getting to know the organization. And I really, really hope that none of my listeners ever have to use your services, but it's comforting that it's there, and it does good work, and it does it for free. And I think you guys are saints. So thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having us and spreading the word. I mean, obviously the one thing about our work is that it affects everybody. I mean, it's very hard for somebody not to know somebody who has suffered a loss. So it's very universal, and you're giving us a voice. So we are forever grateful.
No, I'm honored to do it. Thanks, Sandy.